like that.
I'm a very confident front runner for Caddy for 33 years, 145 wins now, and that's the best win I've ever had.
I have no idea what you have.
I don't know. How are we going to count all the shots? I can't keep track.
Fuck! God damn it!
I don't think he's pleased.
Of course he would. That's a particularly stupid question. It's the Irish Open. Of course we want to play at the weekend.
You are welcome along to another Golf Weekly. Dave McIntyre in the hot seat alongside me this week. Hello, Dave.
Hello there.
And once again, Fionn Davenport in Manchester is crystal clear. Hello.
Gentlemen.
So once again, you've braved the elements and left your comfy home and gone to Salford.
Do you think I live in the Arctic?
This level of dedication, Joe, I'll admit I was away last week, so didn't listen to the pod.
Yeah.
My one issue with it is that if he is willing to find studio space every time he's unable to join you here, it's going to significantly reduce my number of appearances on this podcast.
Well, I'm on holidays next week. So.
Gone for a month.
I thought you were going to say
the one issue is you can't see his beautiful face.
That's true.
That too.
That is true. The it's just, you know what it is? Well, we're recording at 5:30, break the fourth wall, 5:30 on a Thursday evening.
5:48.
It's just the traffic is Salford and you're coming through traffic, and it's only like 3 miles from door to door, but it takes 45 minutes to get here.
Ooh, you need to get a bike.
Yeah.
Especially for Golf Weekly, you need to invest in it.
Exactly.
A bike.
Anyway.
So, much to talk about. Nathan Murphy, not here this week, not here next week.
Oh.
Right.
I think it's just me.
I may get another shout next week.
I think it's
inevitable. Fingers crossed.
Yeah. So much to talk about. Obviously, we have the WGC, we have Rory and JP news, which kind of came out of nowhere. And also, we have Ron Green Jr. on the podcast. I spoke to him earlier. He wrote an article about David Duval, which a number of listeners tweeted to us and said, you should get this guy on. So we've done that and I've spoken to him and we will play that for you on this podcast. Very interesting, you know. David Duval. The most interesting thing about him, I suppose, is that he wins the British Open, as we'll now start calling it, wins the British Open, and pretty much has what he describes as an existential moment where he thought to himself, this isn't as amazing as I was hoping it would be.
And is this what it's all about?
Yeah, kind of. Now, still tried to keep going, and injuries were a huge part of it. You know, it's not like he suddenly gave up in golf, as Ron will tell us, but injuries are a huge part of it. And maybe just some valve of pressure was released that he didn't quite feel he needed it as much, you know.
He glimpsed paradise and saw that it wasn't everything he thought it would be.
Yeah. Although, as I said to Ron, it's kind of interesting because the majority of people who glimpse paradise, either they win that one major and it's enough for them and they're satisfied and they don't drive themselves as hard ever again because it was so wonderful. Yeah, and it fulfills them so much. Or there are the, I suppose, Tiger Woods, Jordan Spieth types who glimpse paradise, realize it's paradise and it's like heroin and they want to keep doing it again and again and again. It seems to be one of those two extremes, as opposed to a Duval who got there and seemed to say, I mean, it's nice, but...
Also, Duval, he wasn't an all-saran. He's not a Paul Laurie. He's not Darren Clarke winning the major that his talent deserved kind of at the tail end of his career. He won it in the full flow of his career. And the only reason he hadn't won up to that point is because of Tiger Woods. Mm. And yeah, so it's an interesting one because he was like the second best player in the world.
He was the best player in the world at one stage. He was the world number one.
He did get to the world number one. It's true.
Yeah. In 1999, he got to world number one for 15 weeks. Interestingly, and Ron will tell us about it, Tiger Woods contributes to this piece by email.
Oh.
Such is his respect for David Duval, he wanted to get across just how much he respected Duval as a player. And Ron and Tiger Woods have a decent relationship. They will email each other from time to time as the piece happened in the piece. So we'll talk to Ron about Tiger Woods another time. So that's on the way. Your tweets before we get into the business at hand. Kevin Kelly says you can keep your 440-yard drives, Dustin Johnson. I'm watching Jordan Spieth drain 50 footers. That's my kind of box office machine. Because, Jordan Spieth today is 3 under thus far. It may have changed with two or three holes to go. But DJ, who's 3 under as well, hit a 469-yard drive on 16.
It's the longest drive on tour in 4 years.
Yeah, he still has to lay up. It's a stupid hole, apparently. It's the dumbest par five ever, so he got no benefit from it. Big Bang Little Tappy says, kudos, lads, for keeping the pod momentum going last week. # friend of the pod. # Dublin to Manchester. That was all you, Fionn, your travels. So a few people saying thank you for doing that. Shea Dempsey said, is Rory McIlroy possibly following the latest trend, having a friend or someone the same age as you as a caddy, he wonders, like Jordan and DJ. We'll come back to that. Kevin Price, hey, at Golf Weekly NT, anxiously awaiting a new pod, hashtag friend of the pod, hashtag Rory's caddy. Everybody very interested in this caddy business. Simon Madden points out, so, hashtag McIlroy sacks JP to save their friendship and then puts his best friend on the bag. Hashtag bizarre. I guess if he stays on the bag, yeah, it's kind of odd then.
We don't think he's going to stay though, do we?
Does seem unlikely.
We don't think they'll be together long enough for this relationship to be irreparably damaged.
Yeah. Buffalo Bills said he went to Castle Dargan in Sligo last week and played his first round in 17 years, lads. I'm not long finished. Hashtag inspired by the pod.
That's our work done. You just seal it
inspiring
up now.
Inspiring people.
We could just change the golfing life of one person out there. That's our job done.
Absolutely.
First round in 17 years.
I'll walk the 3 miles to get into studio to do that.
David Horan on last week's chat. Couldn't agree more with Fionn Spieth is now a Jedi instead of a choker. Limitless is his take. And Joe Kelly on our chat last week. Just listening now, lads, the discussion on the best back nine ever in a major, obviously in light of Spieth. He mentions Charles Schwartzel in 2011, worth a mention. I guess it was, but all you can really think of is Rory's collapse. We mentioned Jack, yeah. Rory's collapse sort of overshadows Schwartzel swooping in. When you think of 2011, you just think of Rory's collapse. You don't really think of Schwartzel. I can't remember any of the shots he hit.
Same way that when you think of that 1996 Masters, you don't really think about the fact that Faldo shot a bogey-free 67.
No, it's true. But I mentioned it last week, but you're dead right. It actually was a terrific round of golf by Faldo. Never mind Norman, you know.
Yeah, just to keep the pressure up on him. I think we mentioned it on the pod a couple of weeks ago. Schwartzel pretty much eaten away McIlroy's lead by the time McIlroy walked off the first green, because Schwartzel had holed out, I think it was from the second fairway for eagle, and suddenly a four-shot lead was won, I think, by the time McIlroy bogeyed the first green and walked off. But you're right, a few people could actually tell you who won the 2011 Masters, let alone who shot the best back nine on it.
When are you guys going to get Seamus Power in the pod? Another good finish last weekend. He's up to 126, not getting much love, says Darren O'Sull.
I have been trying to get Seamus Power on the pod/show for quite some time, and it's not proving to be quite as easy as I thought it might.
Well, you didn't try hard enough, Dave.
Yeah.
I have good news. Seamus Power will be on the podcast next week.
Splendid. Oh, yeah. I'm going to be on the pod next week.
Well, hey.
Return my call, Seamus?
Do you want to know how difficult it was? Dave McIntyre trying so hard here for the last... slogging for weeks. We rang his old golf course in Waterford.
That's what I did.
They gave us his number. We texted him. He said, okay.
Maybe he has changed his number, because all they would give me was an email address. And I did send an email and I sent a follow-up email.
But that's the kind of doggedness that you learned in journalism school, Joe, you know?
Mm.
Did you go to journalism
school? Follow every lead.
No. And quite honestly, if we text him and he hadn't written back, that would have been as far as we would have.
Well, yeah, I admit I didn't care enough to worry about the lack of response.
But he's at an interesting point, Power. So he's 1-2-6 in the FedEx, and there are three tournaments left. So we'll be good to talk.
Is he playing the Barracuda this week?
No, he's on holiday. Oh, he is playing this week. He's on holiday next week.
Peculiar week. Why is he going on holiday?
Look, that's what he told us.
Maybe he doesn't have a place in the field next week.
Don't know. I didn't question it with him.
Right.
Anyway, we should speak to him next week, hopefully. Ian Kane says, such a nice picture. First day of holidays in Lagos, Portugal, listening to the pod. Hashtag friend of the pod. Hashtag relaxed. And Put for Dough says to you, Fionn, that Niall Horan might get the nod.
Yeah.
Be a big one.
Do you know, I've noticed that when you read out, you read out all of the text, including all of the hashtags, and it's slightly reminiscent of the text that used to come into Love Island, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Where they have to read out the hashtag.
Hashtag.
Mm.
I've got
very
a text.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. Love Island banter.
Are you hearing that echo?
Slight echo, yeah. On Paul's line.
As long as it doesn't piss our listeners off.
Well, they're just going to have to deal with it. Yeah, Love Island. What a show. I actually miss Love Island. It's a genuine confession.
I haven't seen it since Kelly Brook hosted it.
If you watch ITV in the mornings at the moment, Christine Bleakley is filling in for Lorraine, and every day they have a different couple from Love Island share their experiences of the real world now that they've left the island. Will love survive? Will love grow? And it seems yes is the answer to both those questions.
I must start watching some of that.
Yeah.
Somebody else says, oh yeah, Matt Davis, might have misheard you. Did you use the phrase streets ahead on the pod? I presume we did. I looked where Matt's from. He's from Parkersburg, West Virginia, where streets ahead mustn't be a saying.
Is that a particularly Irish thing, do you think?
I hadn't thought so until now. Streets ahead, miles ahead. A long way ahead, Matt. And Ross Williams played Waterville Golf Links last Sunday. Course is incredible. Teed off at 6:30 a.m. Finished 9:40 a.m. Hashtag friend of the pod. Never played Waterville. Presume it's lovely. I hear good things. Mick O'Dwyer, man who plays down there, doesn't he?
He does.
Yeah.
Tiger Woods used to play it when he would prep for the Open.
Did he?
Yeah. South and Mark O'Meara would be regular visitors there.
At Waterville?
Yeah.
I think O'Meara played there the week before he won the Open.
Wow.
In 98.
Right. Okay. They all come over and play Ireland a lot, don't they, pre-Open?
Mm.
Dustin Johnson seems to come to Ireland as well the week before the Open a good bit. Phil Mickelson would as well.
Not lately, though, have they?
Yeah, Phil was in Dublin before the Open this week.
He was?
Yeah. He was doing, I mean, he was over, he was doing a KPMG thing as well.
Did he play?
I'd say so.
Where did he go out? Portmarnock or the Island or somewhere, Royal Dublin?
Kind of assume one of them,
Beltray, somewhere up the East Coast.
Somewhere like that. So, they're your tweets for this week. Now, Rory McIlroy. This came out of nowhere. The first person to tell me this was happening was Fionn Davenport on Monday night. And I scoffed.
You did? Do you know, I'm glad you admit that.
Okay.
Because you're like Ronan Keating. You say it best when you say nothing at all. Because your text was like, what? But the subtext was, shut up.
Yeah.
That's just nonsense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the respect I have for you as a source. But look, you've never broken any golf stories before.
That is absolutely true. I doubted myself. I was given this information, but all of it I was given. Both the fact that JP had been fired and that Harry Diamond would be on the bag for the subsequent tournaments. And yeah, so I texted yourself and Nathan and then I doubted myself.
Who told you this?
I can't tell you who told me that.
Who's your source?
Oh, okay. Oh, when I said I couldn't tell you. Oh yeah, my source is a friend of mine who would know JP's world quite well.
Okay. Well, you see, when I saw the news, I thought, well, like, it doesn't seem like they had a big falling out. And there's just no way you would do this ahead of the USPGA, where you two together have had great success here.
But is it not the best time to do it, given that his season hasn't gotten out of second gear, really?
But that, I hear what you're saying, although that has nothing to do with JP on the face of it. That's
no,
because he's
true.
Had such a disrupted season between the equipment and the injury, and like that is the reason he hasn't gotten into fifth gear, and it's just strange. Well, we'll play the audio of him at the press conference. Maybe it's the best thing, and then we can all weigh in and give our thoughts. So this was Wednesday. This was last night. Today being Thursday, and Rory sat down, and obviously this was the first thing he was asked about. So he's made a big change.
Yeah, look, it is. It's a big change. JP has been a huge part of my life for the last decade. You know, we started in July 2008 and went all the way up until July this year. And a lot of great times, a lot of great times on and off the golf course. I mean, I still consider JP one of my best friends, one of my closest friends. But sometimes to preserve a personal relationship, you might have to sacrifice a professional one. And that was sort of the decision that I came to in the end. I was getting very hard on him on the golf course, and I didn't want to treat someone that I don't want to treat anyone like that, but sometimes this game drives you to that. I felt like it was the right thing to do, and I don't think there was any good time to do it. It was a really tough decision to make. But I thought, you know, I'm coming to Firestone. I have four tournament rounds to either get to know someone or get used to having someone else on my bag going into the last major of the year. And that's really it. You know, I thank JP for everything. JP knows how much I think of him, how much he means to me, what we've achieved together. And it wasn't an easy decision, but at the end of the day, I felt like it was a change that I needed to make because, you know, I'd much rather be, and I got to the point where, if I didn't play a good shot or if I made a wrong decision, I was getting more frustrated at him than I was at myself. I'd much rather be angry at myself and angry at myself for making a wrong decision than being angry at him. And that was really why. So like, there's nothing to say that JP mightn't work for me again at some point, but you know, right now, you know, I just felt like I needed a little bit of a change. And like, I hate the term fired or sacked or axed, because that's definitely not what it was. You know, I just changed my path a little bit, but you know, maybe in the future that path might come back to that, you know, come back to where it was. But right now I just needed to mix things up a little bit, and JP understood that, and we're still all good.
What was the catalyst, I guess? Was there a moment that really got you thinking in that direction?
Yeah, look, it's been, I think with being on tour and you know, player caddy relationships, they have their ups and downs, and you know, there was probably just a few too many of those over the past year or so. And you know, I've been sort of putting this line out there for a while that I'm trying to take ownership of my game a little bit more, and I'm trying to take a little bit more responsibility on. And I felt like for me to do that, you know, obviously it's Harry, who's my best friend, was my best man at my wedding for, you know, it's him for the next 2 weeks, and we'll see how that goes. But at least now, you know, it's new for both of us, I guess, so we can both get into it, and I can take on a bit more of the responsibility. And I've actually enjoyed that. You know, I've enjoyed the last couple of days of carrying a yardage book, doing my own numbers, pacing stuff out, really getting into the shot. Something I haven't done for a few years. So yeah, you know, it's just, I felt like it was one of those times that I needed to mix something up a little bit. But I don't think there was a certain moment at the Open, or there was this, you know, it was just a build up of stuff that I felt like I just needed to make that change.
There we are. So thoughts on that, fellas? Dave?
The story itself doesn't surprise me, and I know you're a little surprised by the timing of it. I'm not probably that surprised by the timing of it either, because if it was going to happen between now and the end of the season, given how much golf he's planning on playing between this week, the PGA, and then the FedEx Cup playoffs are looming large on the horizon, having a tournament where there's no cut make perfect sense to get rid of him so he could have four rounds with Harry Diamond and bed things in as much as they possibly can do before Quail Hollow. Yeah. But I saw a really interesting line from Bob Harrigan, ESPN, talking about it. He wrote that it makes complete sense for McIlroy to sack Fitzgerald now, having praised him so publicly at the Open. Had everybody been saying that he had to make a change now, as was the case a couple of years ago, his stubbornness would have won out. So McIlroy was never going to sack JP because Jay Townsend was suggesting that he had the wrong man in his bag. He gets rid of him, having told the world what an influence he had in his opening round, turning it around from 5 over to 1 over on the back nine at Birkdale. But it's going back to when he was 19 in 2008, and if there's more downs than ups and you're spending that much time in the company of somebody that isn't your family, sometimes I think it's no surprise. All the great caddy player relationships have split at some stage. Even the one that we thought was unbreakable with Phil and Bones.
Yeah.
And the one that's still there is Fluff and Jim Furyk. That's going 20 years at this stage. It's quite remarkable. But
yeah.
And Tom Watson and his caddy, They had a split. I mean, there's been books written about Edwards and Tom Watson. They had to go their separate ways, and Edwards wanted to go another way. He went with Greg Norman at one stage. So I'm not really surprised.
Yeah.
It's usually the caddy that gets kicked out first, because the player will probably turn to himself lastly when it comes to try and find reasons for the fact that you're not playing well. I don't think it's a massive deal, really. I know it's being made out to be a huge deal.
Yeah.
I don't think it is. And at the time we're recording, he's joint top of the leaderboard in Akron.
Yeah, he's 4 under through 16 last way at the time I looked. Adam Scott's the leader in 5 under. So he has started off very, very nicely in Akron. Fionn?
I don't think it's that big a deal. But what he said, just there's something in the way the story is put out that just, I want to bang my head off a wall. It's like, okay, imagine this. It's not a player and it's not a caddy. It's talking to someone that you've been seeing for a while. It's not me. It's not you. It's me. Look, I need to find myself. You know, And you really deserve to be with someone who really appreciates you for who you are. Because
is that what you wanted him to say? Do you want him to say this relationship has gone sour?
But that's what he said.
And JP couldn't work together anymore.
No. What he's doing is that I did it to protect our friendship, which is horseshit.
Yeah, but that's just a public line.
No, I understand that. That's the point. Here's the thing, okay? You make the point, Dave, and you're right. Player-caddy relationships go sour. It's just the nature of it. You're spending a huge amount of time, a huge amount of under-pressure time. Just say, I wanted to make a change. Like, I find all of these bromides about, I'm doing it to protect our friendship. I don't understand. Rory seems very keen on portraying himself as a fundamentally good guy. Now, I have no doubt that he is fundamentally a good guy. But, like, I just don't buy any of this. I'm doing it to protect her. Like, he's one of my best friends.
I think that is a bit obviously too strong. But, the best friends part of it. Like, I would be surprised if he and JP spoke between now and Christmas.
I would be surprised. Yeah, I mean, and it's not that, you know, I find it's this idea that he doesn't need to portray himself as this, like, oh, shucks, oh, look, you know, he's my best friend. And I just really, I don't want to hurt him, you know. It's like, meanwhile, JP was earned, you know, north of £1 million, you know, carrying his bag over the last 12 months, is now looking for a new bag. And there won't be another bag as lucrative as Rory's. So I think I agree with you. It's not that big a deal. And also, as well, as it's worth pointing out, and I think you mentioned it, Dave, that, you know, there's been rumours about it for the last couple of years. Remember, was it that Golf Digest had done interviews ahead of the Masters in April of all various golfers anonymously? And the stuff, remember, we covered it at the time, and the stuff on Rory was very interesting, yeah, where players were saying, like, I'm listening to JP give him yardages and tell him, you know, hit a soft draw with the 6-iron. And guys are aghast, are going, this ball's going way over the green. And sure enough, that's what happened. So players had been saying to Rory, you need to make a change. Now, which is a horrendously harsh thing for JP. And in fairness to Rory, if anybody criticised JP in the past, Rory was first to jump to his defence.
Yeah.
You know, he was absolutely adamant he was going to protect his man, and rightly so, I thought. So I think this is a long time coming. I think the change is necessary. It's not JP's fault that Rory isn't playing well. But perhaps what Rory needs, Rory looks around, he looks at Jordan Spieth and Michael Greller. He looks at Dustin Johnson, who's got his brother on the bag. He looks at Padraig Harrington, who has Ronan Flood on the bag. He looks at Phil Mickelson, who's put Tim on the bag now. These relationships, when he talks about my best friend Harry Diamond, and we can talk in a second about whether Harry Diamond will stay in the bag, I think not. But I think he wants a guy who's closer to him, more of a peer, someone that he relates to, that's going to be part of his group and he's going to be very comfortable with.
So for life off the course almost as much as on the course.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that. But I think ultimately I watched the press conference and I just felt there's no need for any of these pseudo, you know, marketing spun bromides. Just say, look, I made a decision. I needed a change. My golf game, everything has to, I have to do things. And, you know, I'm sad. JP's a good caddy. I wished him well and we went our separate ways. For him to say, oh, there's no reason why we mightn't work again in the future. That's like saying, look, I really hope that we can be friends. It's like, what are you doing? It's like the relationship is over and that's fine. It happens. JP, you know, he caddied for Ernie, caddied for Paul McGinley, he caddied for Darren Clark. Darren Clark actually fired JP and used the exact same excuse in 2004. He said, I did it to protect our friendship.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, in 2004. He said virtually line for line. And so that was kind of interesting. But yeah, so, you know, but of course, because he's Irish, because, you know, he's under our microscope and because rumours have been on and on for quite a long time about whether Rory needed a different kind of caddy. And I think that's interesting. I think Rory needs a different kind of caddy.
Yeah, well, it's whether he wants to have that different kind of caddy, I guess, is going to be interesting because, you know, he's stubborn to his detriment a lot of the time. I suppose Rory was never going to come out and throw JP under the bus, clearly. So he was never,
no,
you know.
But who does? Nobody does. No player fires a caddy and throws him under a bus. He just goes, I wanted to make a change. You know, that was it. And I'm moving on.
Yeah.
And I think that's all that was required, really.
Yeah, but I think he actually wanted to almost offer up some kind of convincing alternative to
a sacking.
Yeah. And
but
this
idea,
the one...
it's not a sack. He's not been fired. He's not been axed. He's not been sacked. I wonder what JP thinks about that.
No, well, sure. Like that's a
firing.
Yeah, no, yeah. That was that. Yeah,
last week he was the caddy. This week he's not. So he's been sacked.
Yeah, absolutely.
Unless it's a case of JP said, I've had enough of this. And it would appear from what Rory said yesterday, that is not the case.
No.
No.
My point is, like when he says I'm being too hard on him, nobody actually really said to Rory,
is it because he made mistakes?
Pretty much. Are there solid reasons why you are getting frustrated with him? Because that Golf Digest thing really opened up a lot of our eyes to maybe the possibility that one of the reasons Rory seems to miss more greens quite wildly at times is that it's down to the caddy. Because I don't think it's quite possible that JP is as bad as people say.
No, I absolutely agree with you. Yeah.
Like, I honestly do think if I caddied for Rory for 6 months, I'd get a good feel for how far he's hitting the ball. It's not that complicated, you know.
No.
This is how far he hits a six.
What if you're getting the yardage wrong, though?
See,
that's getting the club wrong is one thing, but actually delivering the wrong yardage to the player is...
Well, but
I can't imagine any professional caddy out there is giving the player the wrong yardage.
Yeah, I can't either. That's my feeling. Like, I mean...
But McIlroy must know how far he hits it.
McIlroy must know. JP must know. I find it almost unbelievable that JP would be given the wrong yardage or have the wrong yardage.
You hit your 8-iron 155 yards.
Yeah.
But I think you should hit a 7 here. Yeah. McIlroy will then go, well, no, I know what I hit my 8.
Yeah.
So,
because part of me is very sceptical of that line from Golf Digest. And I don't doubt Golf Digest. I don't doubt the writer. I don't doubt the source. But it just seems odd to me that JP could be saying hit a 6-iron, and even a player who doesn't play with Rory all the time is looking at him thinking this is going to fly the green, and sure enough it flies the green. Like, that just seems too unbelievable to me to be a routine mistake that JP is making.
There is the possibility, perhaps, and you know, I'd be with you, Joe, it's improbable, but there is the possibility that a certain amount of complacency had set in. I mean, here, I was thinking about, obviously, when I heard the news first, and I was thinking about it, the whys and the wherefores. Rory comes on tour. He is 19 years old. His team is assembled around him. Now, obviously, he has some say, but, you know, he's a rookie. He's 19. So he is allowing for certain decisions to be made. JP was an experienced caddy who had caddied for two Irishmen. So, you know, he's someone in the family, as it were. So someone who could nurture and take care of this young kid as he progressed through the ranks of the pros. He's 20 years older than him. There is a huge gap in both experience and the way of seeing the world, you know. So I don't know. Like, I think that JP's a different... I would wager, without knowing at all, but I would wager that JP was told, look, you're being given the bag of arguably the greatest golfer, you know, next to Tiger Woods, that's going to play the game. So your job is carry the bag, clean the clubs, give him the yardages, hand him the club, and just stay out of his way. And I think he's done that, for better or worse, for the last 9 years. They've won four majors, you know, so you can hardly say it wasn't a huge success. And I think Rory's gotten to a point now where that kind of placid caddy is no longer what he needs. And like, to go back to the Golf Digest thing, it's like they were saying, if he had Billy Foster on the bag, do you think that Billy Foster is a bulshy little so-and-so. So Billy Foster would like argue his point much more vociferously. I would say that JP from day one was told, you're not arguing with Rory here. Rory is a field golfer. He'll make decisions. You just give him the club. And I think that's where the problem lies.
I think you've hit on a really interesting point there, but not maybe the one you finished with there. You said, you know, JP suited the needs of the 18-year-old, 19-year-old prodigy. Mm. A guy who's been on tour for 20 years, he's caddied for major champions and was able to nurture him through the pitfalls of being on tour, where to eat, where the locker rooms are, what happens on certain putting greens, what the etiquette around the driving range is, stuff that maybe a rookie professional just wouldn't be aware of. and the needs that JP catered to or fulfilled back then, Rory has just outgrown that. And now he would like to have a mate of his, like Harrington and Rona Flood, who can just go and have dinner together, have a couple of drinks together, talk about sports, talk about women, talk about whatever it is they want to talk about their sort of 28-year-old view on the political system that Rory seems to be so into at the moment. And not someone who's 20 years older than you that isn't your dad. And maybe it's just that he has just outgrown JP and he doesn't need JP for the things he needed him for back in 2008.
Yeah. Yes, they're all fair points. Like, JP's had a terrible amount of stick over the last number of years. I often feel sorry for him because it must be very embarrassing. And he's held his counsel brilliantly, very dignified. Yeah. You know, when Jane Townsend comes out and slams him for horrific course management that he hasn't seen since outside of underage golf. Yeah. And JP said nothing about that.
He was making a fortune, though.
Sure, but I mean, that was...
It doesn't matter. No, but still,
embarrassing, you know?
In fairness, Rory, that's the point. Rory came out and absolutely hit Townsend hard with that, and rightly so. There was no need for that, like, to personalise an attack.
No.
You know, it really is, there is no need.
But and, let's just assume that diamond is not the answer. Because
you know, this is a really good golfer. They've known each other since they were kids. He plays off plus 2.5 of a handicap. He played Ulster Utes with Rory. He's a businessman. He's a wealthy guy. Like, I mean, I can't imagine that he might be, you know, he might be Rory's best friend, but do you think that he will adapt to the life of a caddy?
No, I think it's unrealistic. I think diamond is the short term option. See how that goes. Maybe it goes well. Maybe they do it for the rest of the season. But I think ultimately he's going to get a different caddy. So then you're onto the interesting point. So this might boil down to an example I often go to when I do think, oh, JP, what are you doing sometimes? Like, Lawrence Donegan used the example the other night of 2011 Masters when Rory's trying to hit when he hits the snap hook and then out of the rough he's hitting a big tree wood and it was just a crazy decision. He often says that's where JP should have stepped in and said, what the hell are you doing? But the other more recent one maybe is the Masters last year where on the 11th he's in the trees. That's the hole. Obviously everyone knows that feeds down right to left into the water and Rory goes in the trees and he's going to hook the ball out of the trees and try and hook it onto the green and everybody, all the commentary are saying, this crazy shot, everything in that fairway feeds into that water. He should not be trying to hook this out. He should be being very safe down the right-hand side, try and chip on, try and save par. JP let him do it. It just seemed like a crazy thing to do.
Okay.
I'll just finish the point.
Yeah.
JP let him do it. He hooks it out, bounces into the water. This was second or third round, and it was a needless risk to take. It was just silly. So does Rory want someone going forward? If we're saying JP has outgrown the early part of Rory's needs. So does Rory now just want someone that he can have dinner with and be on the same wavelength as outside of the course, which is one option? Mm. Or the second option is, does Rory want a Steve Williams type or a Michael Greller type, as we saw the 13th last week, who will walk into him in the trees, take that club out of his hand and say, absolutely not. Do not hit the hook shot. Play safe. We'll chip on, we'll make par. That's what we're doing here. That is like, and argue the case strongly. So we can all agree he wants someone his own age or similar wavelength. But does he want someone who's just that? Or does he want someone who's going to boss him around the course a bit more? That's what I'm really interested to see. And I think if he goes for the latter, that would be a real sign of maturity. That would be an understanding that at times his course management can be suspect and at times he needs a strong voice there with him.
But his own words would seem to suggest that no, that's not what he wants. Yeah. When he says, I'm trying to take ownership of my game a little more, I'm trying to take responsibility. I actually listened to you and Lawrence Donegan the other night, and I was thinking about, and the part that always, and it's not your conversation, but I found the idea, people go, oh, he should have. If from day one he's told, you are never to do that, JP can't do that.
I don't think he was told that.
Personally. I think JP was told you have to let Rory's genius come through. And here's the alternative one, right? Do you remember Mickelson hits the miracle shot off the pine straw, right? Now, if that shot had gone haywire, it would have been, that would have been the one. What was Mikkelsen doing? Why didn't Bones say something to him? He should have said something to him. Why didn't he? Should have taken the club out of his hands. So maybe, you know, had Rory hit that miracle shot and hooked around and he found the green, everyone would have gone, oh my God, see, he's a genius. He can do it. I'm betting you anything that Rory 100% believed that he had both those shots in his bag, that he could have made them. That's why he, you know, sorry, that's the point. I think JP, the relationship they had precluded him from ever being able to do that. That's, so I think in defense of JP, I mean, I agree with you. He should have. He should have taken the club out of his hand. But I just don't think he had that relationship with
him. Like, funny enough, it wasn't really a criticism of JP. It's more just an illustration of that's the relationship. Like,
yep.
There was the famous, not famous, but there was a tournament a couple of months ago where Rory's hitting a shot. You know, the cameras are so close now and the sound guy is so close you can hear everything. And JP walked back in to say, maybe you shouldn't do this or maybe you shouldn't do something. And Rory just said, no, I've got it. And JP straight away turned, walked off. And
walked off, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that's more of a sign of where their relationship had got to, though.
I was talking
McIlroy
to...
McIlroy wasn't going to really... He had already realised that the relationship was going sour, that even just at that stage. I don't think that's just because McIlroy had an arrangement with JP that you, under no circumstances, ever come in and say that to me.
Yeah.
And you said, Fionn, that the relationship would have precluded JP from making those sort of interventions. I probably think that's a little too strong.
So do I. I think that's, I think that's too formal.
That's just not the relationship they had.
Yeah.
The other point, sorry, I think your second point, Joe, about the kind of caddy he wants is the key one now. And it's very interesting. But there's another thing. Now, I spoke to an Irish pro up at Port Stewart and we were kind of musing about. And one of the things he said, he goes, look, you know, Rory has problems reading greens and JP's not that good a green reader either. So between them both, you know, you're not in... Like, one or the other has to be brilliant at reading greens. And I thought, I mean, it hasn't been mentioned at all, but I just thought I'd bring it up. That could be a factor as well, that if you're making, like, really forensic decisions moving forward, that you're going, okay, right, well, you know, we need someone, I need help maybe, or I need someone who's got an extra pair of eyes that I absolutely can trust on the greens.
Green reader wanted.
Yeah.
How do you advertise for that kind of a caddy? Huh.
Well, it's not, I mean, sorry, when I say that Rory can't read greens, of course he can read greens, but he's not Tiger Woods reading greens, if you know what I mean, or Jordan Spieth at reading greens, or Greller, for the point. Greller, by all accounts, is an amazing green reader.
Yeah, so, Bones, that was one of his real strengths.
So, but anyway, sorry, I just wanted to bring that up. But your point is that it goes back to that thing. If Rory is saying, I'm trying to take ownership of my game a little more, it says that I'm going to keep going the way I am because I'm a feel player. That's who I am. But if that's the way I'm going to continue, I want someone in my bag that I can kind of relax with, that I can feel that has my back or is my friend or, you know, or someone that I have a more intimate relationship with than I do with JP, who, as we said, is, you know, 20 years older, you know, different perspectives, et cetera, et cetera.
There are real echoes of the Harrington situation in 2006.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's an awful lot of parallels. There was a lot of controversy at the time because it was felt that he was snatching a home Ryder Cup away from his caddy, and because this is the weeks before the K Club, and it's obviously worked out brilliantly. But I think there was real parallels in terms of the relationship that he wanted with his caddy when they walked off the 18th green and were finished practicing for the day. They were going to share a bottle of wine and dinner. And I think McIlroy will feel far more comfortable over these next few weeks with Harry Diamond in that role. Mm-hmm. Now, who else can he possibly find that will fulfill that?
Yeah.
Because there's not too many guys that are in a position where they can just give up whatever it is they're doing and just decide to become a full-time caddy.
Yeah.
Interesting times ahead.
Yeah, we'll see how it unfolds. So, thus far, Rory has started day one at the WGC very, very nicely. Spieth is there on 3 under. Day was even. DJ was 3 under. Adam Scott, the leader, on 5 under. Adam Scott, by the way, has benched Steve Williams, if we're just finishing
has
up on the
benched him?
Caddy themes.
So, it won't be a Quail Hollow anyway.
In a bid to shake up his lacklustre season, Adam Scott will rest caddy Steve Williams from a major championship for the first time in more than 2 years.
Wow.
Yeah, now out to world number 17, Scott confirmed he will use his part-time bagman David Clark at next week's USPGA and in this week's WGC. So he's winless since February 2016, currently 70th on the FedEx. He's going to sit out the FedEx at the end of the season, Scott, because his wife is pregnant and he's so far down the money list.
Can I just sorry, one final thought on the Rory thing. I hope he doesn't go for a celebrity caddy. I mean, like a Steve Williams type or, you know, a name. I hope he just goes for a caddy that suits him, not a caddy that suits the brand or you know, yeah, that reflects the global nature of Rory McIlroy Inc.
Yeah,
you know?
The early favourite at the moment is Danny Willett's caddy, Smart.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah.
I did say there were parallels to Harrington in 2006. There are also parallels to McIlroy in 2014 in the week where he ended his prospective marriage with Caroline Wozniacki, yeah, and then went to Wentworth, a course that he supposedly, yeah, didn't like the setup, and goes and wins, and then follows up a couple of months later with two majors.
Both breakups were by phone.
But by phone, or both were it's not you, it's me.
It's not you, it's me. Let's be friends, though, please. You know.
All righty, we're leaving off, Rory. So a few other bits before we get to the David Duval piece. There's really nothing much to say about this except that it's awful. David Faraday popped into all our Twitter feeds. Just like you see so much inane stuff on Twitter, it almost felt inappropriate that this thing just popped up.
Yeah. But, what can you say?
Yeah. My firstborn son is gone from me, dying from an overdose on his 29th birthday. Bless his sweetheart. I will fight on. So David Faraday's son died on his birthday, Shea Faraday. He died on Saturday. Funeral service was in Dallas on Tuesday. Faraday, obviously 58 years old, based in Dallas. So he's had his own issues with substance addiction,
gosh, yeah.
David Faraday. But yeah, 29-year-old Shea Faraday, overdose, horrific stuff. And
yeah.
I guess there's not much more you can say about it, really.
No. And Faraday, but I liked Faraday's dignity in being able to just say what happened. I mean, this is a guy who, as you said, you know, he used to take 40 Vicodin a day and drink two bottles of whiskey, you know, so, and he's been, also as well, he's been sober since 2005. So watching your firstborn go through stuff that you went through and found a way out of has to be doubly heartbreaking. Mm. And the pain of it cannot be underestimated. So
all terribly, yeah, avoidable. So that's very sad news from the world of golf. Some other small bits. The Women's British Open is on this week. Michelle Wee shot a course record today at Kingsbarn. Shot a 64. I was watching the highlights. Very, very,
yeah,
good.
Yeah, so was I.
Yeah, she was pretty awesome, obviously.
There's 9 people there.
Oh, really?
Oh, it's empty. I was watching it earlier on. It's empty.
Yeah, the galleries are hardly packed.
No. And the weather is gorgeous, you know, gorgeous blue skies, fairly clement conditions. Mm-hmm. And then one of the Koreans, I think, was threatening Michelle Wee's score.
Right.
The last one, I turned it off.
Kingsbarn's pretty easy, by all accounts.
Yeah, fair enough.
But, there's a couple of other interesting tidbits from the world of golf. Uh-huh. As we walked in, Steph Curry was 1 over through 3. The Ellie Mae Classic in San Francisco, making
that's
his professional debut.
Not very good.
No.
Hang on. He was what? How
one
many?
Over through 3 holes.
Oh, sorry.
At the LMA Classic on the web.com tour.
I'm often 1 over through 3 holes.
I could keep that pace. Yeah.
Now, for all we know, he could be 2 or 3 under now at this stage, in the time we've been spending talking about
the
Rory.
Not
such good form from the former Dallas quarterback, Tony Romo.
Tony Romo.
Because he was playing in the Western Amateur this week. He missed the cut yesterday. Incurred a one-shot penalty for slow play as well. Uh-huh. Didn't manage to break 80. But the one I wanted to get your thoughts on, Fionn, because you're a historian of the game.
Yeah.
Byron Nelson's green jacket is up for sale this week.
Really?
Yes.
Why?
Now, well, it's not the first time this has happened. Apparently, I'm led to believe Horton Smith's green jacket was sold for $682,000 4 years ago. That was a record price fetched for golf memorabilia. But they reckon the reserve is going to be $25,000, but they think they're going to break about $250,000. Yeah. So if you had the money, Fionn, would you like a green jacket?
No.
Somebody else's green jacket in your wardrobe?
Absolutely. No, absolutely not. Did you see Sergio got married in his?
Oh, he didn't. He just put it on for one dance.
Doesn't matter.
Well, it does
just leave the thing at home, will you? What are you, John Terry?
I do.
Like,
It did seem so naff that he was.
Yeah, it was naff. No, I wouldn't. I mean, surely the only value of a green jacket is because you've won it yourself.
Oh, totally, like, of course, yeah.
You know, why would you want to? Either of you read the Sports Illustrated piece that Alan Shipnuck wrote on golf and Donald Trump? Very interesting.
Yeah, I had a flick through it.
It's really interesting. It's very fair. In fact, it's one of the fairest, most bad. It's not pro or con or anything like that. And it doesn't avoid the politics. It talks about Michael Bamberger, who the journalist who's played golf more times with Donald Trump than anyone else in journalism. He's played with him 9 times and now not for a number of years, but still is very familiar with him. And the point is made is that Trump on the golf course or around golf is a very different man to Trump, the politician or the bombast or the whatever. So they kind of deal with it just in terms of golf. And like the kind of take homes that made me laugh are one is they said that he's a surprisingly limber swing. He had very good hand-eye coordination. He is pretty good at holding putts. He's a very wristy player, real old-fashioned stroke. And so, which is not surprising if you've ever seen YouTube footage of him. He takes tons of mulligans. Putts that he misses don't count. Putts that he makes count. You know, he's the classic kind of rich guy cheater, like Bill Clinton was before him, and you know, a billion other guys.
So that sounds exactly like Donald Trump, the politician.
Yeah.
Well, kind of, yeah. But one of the things that and Bamberger makes the point, because also on the golf podcast, they're, you know, the Sports Illustrated one, the golf.com one, makes a point of saying he's incredibly generous on the golf course.
He seems to be a very good host.
Yeah, he's really good host. He's very affable. Now, what he does, though, is he would irritate the purists because besides the running his golf carts on the greens and whatever, he narrates rather than plays. This is Sports Illustrated spoke with numerous people who have teed it up with Trump over the years and all report that he doesn't play a round of golf so much as narrate it. His commentary peppered with hyperbole. Is this not the most beautiful asphalt you've ever seen in your life? He'll say of an ordinary car path. At the turn, he'll ask, have you ever had a better burger? Now, stuff like that makes me laugh. Bamberger on the podcast tells an anecdote about giving him a lift in his souped-up Bentley, you know, so he gets in and Bamberger goes, you know, the smell of leather is incredible. It's like finished to the highest spec. And so Trump goes, he goes, hey, Michael, have you ever sat in a nicer car? And Bamberger goes, I actually have. And he goes, whose? And he goes, Arnold Palmer's. And there's a moment, and then Donald Trump goes, Bam, you're such an asshole. Which I thought was quite funny.
It reminds me of, I'm rewatching all of Curb Your Enthusiasm at the moment.
And, ah, brilliant.
In one of the early episodes, they're friendly with Ted Danson, and Larry Davis is really bothered by Ted Danson because he's like, with Ted Danson, he's just too happy. Everything's heaven. This day is heaven. Isn't this weather heaven? and isn't this burger heaven? It's all heaven.
Yeah, he says that his handicap. One of the things that Shipnuck says, he is the best player ever to occupy the Oval Office.
Well,
no golfer has been as good as him. However, in typical, he has to gild the lily. This is a guy who says he plays off a handicap of 2.8, and Ernie Els goes, yeah, he's maybe a 9.
That's an American 9 as well.
Yeah, it's an American 9, which is an 11 or a 12 for us. But
it should also be said, Phil, that no other president has worked on his game as much. While
no, it's true. But also as well, Shipnuck went to investigate, because you know he says he's won 18 of these club championships.
Yeah.
There's absolutely no evidence of it anywhere. And so he's like, wow, you know, where are these? And of course, all these championships are played on Trump courses.
Yeah.
He did, however, have a hole-in-one, and he tells a story where the CEO of General Electric was there with him. And so Trump, as president, he's standing on the par three and he says, you realize, of course, I'm the richest golfer in the world. And then hits a shot and gets a hole in one, which is pretty nice.
It's quite the moment.
It is quite the moment. And then the other story that jumped out at me was, he talks about Eric Trump had given an interview to golf.com last year and talked about him, about Donald Trump and Tiger. And he says, my father and Tiger have been friends for a long time. They've been very, very close. When you combine Trump and Tiger, it's a match made in heaven. And this was in relation to a course in Abu Dhabi or Dubai that Tiger is designing for Trump. Trump and his business partners out there. However, Woods' spokesperson, Glenn Greenspan, wrote in reply to golf.com, Tiger is not in partnership with Mr. Trump or his organization, and stating otherwise is absolutely wrong. Tiger Woods' designs, contract and obligations to the developer, DeMac Properties. Our association ends there. I can't put it any clearer than Tiger Woods' design does not have an agreement with Mr. Trump. So Tiger's clearly keen to distance himself from the best friends for life, BFF, yeah, that Eric Trump is portraying. So it's an interesting piece, and I urge you to read it.
It is fair. I mean, Trump comes across very well in,
as a human
respects.
Being. Yeah, like absolutely.
Very, very charming. A real champion of the LPGA would make all the players there feel very welcome and try and charm them and talk to them. Not charm them in a sleazy way, which might be your first thought, but would actually go out of his way to put out the red carpet for them.
The older players, like Natalie Gulbis or Christy Kerr, who knew the lean times, is that Trump's interest in the LPGA boosted money. So, like, you know, introduced the first $1 million purse on the back of Trump agitating on their behalf. And so they would have a huge loyalty to Trump. One of the things that Bamberger says, or Shipnuck, one of the two, I can't remember which, is that the younger players who don't have that more, you know, they don't appreciate that Trump did an awful lot for them in the last 10 years. He also tells a funny story about Natalie Gulbis, who after Ben Roethlisberger, you know, the Pittsburgh Steelers quarterback, had broken up with her, that she was going around saying, yeah, well, Ben dumped me, that he called her up and says, don't you ever say that. From now on, you say you dumped him, because for Trump, it's all about the winning.
It's such a Trump thing to do.
Yeah.
It's so childish. I mean, we'll move off this. The only other thing I thought was just a little bit much is Trump will sometimes respond to a shot he duffed by simply playing a second ball and carrying on as if the first shot never happened.
Yeah.
Like, there's cheating and there's cheating. You can't just duff a ball and then just say, oh, that doesn't count. Duffing is one of those humiliating things that happens in golf that you just have to wear. You can't just say, oh, that doesn't count.
That's not even cheating, though. Like, cheating is when you're trying to pull the wool over somebody's eyes.
Yeah,
yeah, good point.
This is just, well, I'm just going to drop another ball.
Yeah.
Michael Bamberger wrote a big piece about Trump a number of years ago, and he went to him because Trump had told him, I shot a 68 at Bel Air. And Bamberger, who, as I said, has played golf with Trump, goes, there's no way he shot a 68 at Bel Air, which is a notoriously difficult course. So he went to investigate it, and sure enough, found absolutely no evidence that Donald Trump shot a 68, or maybe shot one of his 68s with duff shots and, you know, gimmies and all kinds of mulligans. But then when the piece came out and there was no mention of it, that, you know, about, you know, Trump's famous 68, Trump confronted Bamberger and said, why didn't you put it in? And he goes, because he was Donald at the time, not Mr. President. He said, because I've called the course. I've no evidence whatsoever that you actually shot a 68. And of course, Trump doubles down and goes, I did shoot a 68. And that's it. In the end, you're left with that. It's just like, couldn't you just say you shot a 75? Mm. Like, a 75 is impressive, really impressive at Bel Air. Mm. But like, it's that gilding the lily thing that he does. That's just like, ugh. Anyway.
Yeah, it's worth checking out. We're talking David Duval next. So I spoke with Ron Green Jr. for the first time earlier on today. He writes for Global Golf Post. And frankly, it was a bunch of you guys out there who tweeted at Golf Weekly NT about the piece he wrote about David Duval, which popped up in the last week or two. So we got in touch with Ron. We said the listeners liked your piece, Ron. And that's why you're on the show.
Well, that's nice to hear. We appreciate our readers over there. I know we're working hard to build our readership base all through the area over there. And I'm glad they were intrigued and read the David Duval article.
Yeah, good. So Global Golf Post is where people can check it out. Duval is a fascinating figure, and pretty much any time I see anything written about him, I tend to click in myself. Can we just start with just how bloody good a golfer David Duval was?
Well, I think that's part of what was lost or sort of faded from memory is what you're right. I mean, he was the best golfer in the world for a while. I mean, knocked Tiger Woods out of number one in the world for a time. And when you know, he won, I think, 13 tournaments in a remarkably short period of time, climbed the ladder, won the Open Championship, won the Players' Championship. And as he said, I mean, he was blessed with the ability to stand on any tee and know he could drive it in the fairway, hit his little baby fade out there, and had a lot of heat to it. And I mean, he was just he wasn't invincible, but I mean, he was a guy who, he, you know, Tiger has told people through the years that he would look at other names on leaderboards and figure, okay, I can handle this guy and that guy. Duvall's name was one that sort of glowed out at it because there was a toughness to him and a tenacity that carried him to where he went, and that was number one.
Yeah, so 13 wins on tour, British Open, just the third man in U.S. Tour history to shoot a 59 in a tournament, which he did in January 99. And then, as you said, number one in the world golf rankings for 15 weeks, also in 1999. Brandel Chamblee talks about him, said he was a badass golfer, which was, sums it up nicely, I think.
It does sum it up nicely, you know. And Brandel played against him some. And, you know, you just talk to guys who I remember talking to Davis Love the third for this story, and he was telling a story of how in his prime Duvall had that air about him when he walked in the locker room, sort of looking straight ahead, didn't have a whole lot to do with other people. He was sort of locked into his own world. And I think there was the character of Duvall on the golf course was something that I don't know if we really knew what to make of him, because I mean, he wasn't terribly emotive, and he had those wraparound shades on that sort of hid his eyes and gave him this sort of mysterious look. I mean, in the story, I think there's a part that tells the story of where the wraparound shades came from. It came from an eye issue he had and allergy problems during the spring when he was playing golf at Georgia Tech. It was not meant to create the menacing effect that it did. But when you combine that with sort of his personality and his game, I mean, he was there was a sort of Terminator effect to him.
Yeah, Duvall, or Chamblee rather, tells you a really good story about one of the first times he played with Duvall, and it was a 230-odd yard par 3 into the wind, really, really difficult. Might have been links golf, I'm not sure, but Chamblee, you know, took a 3-wood into that wind and just tried to roll one up there and get it up there, and Duvall took out an iron and just burst the ball and landed near the pin, and Chamblee almost remembers stopping and turning and looking at this guy saying, oh my God.
Yeah, one of those moments like, I got to compete against this guy.
Yeah.
And, I mean, Duvall just, he had it there for a while and just, you really sensed he was just going to, you know, could go a long time. But, he was, as he talked about it later, sort of an existential moment for him after winning the Open Championship and climbing to number one and all that stuff. And, you know, it was characterized as he got to the top of the game and looked around and said, is this all there is? Mm. And it wasn't, when I asked him about it, he said it wasn't quite that simple, but that in essence summed it up. And yeah, he's a guy who sees a lot of things beyond golf, and maybe that's what's helped make him what he is as a television commentator.
Yeah, I remember the Open win, and I remember him speaking afterwards, as is the tradition, obviously, and he was far more emotional than any of us expected. I mean, I presume that wasn't maybe such a surprise to the golf journalists who covered him day in, day out, and maybe got to see more of his character, but certainly to the wider golfing public. When he spoke after that Open win and was so emotional and a real human being and the glasses were off, that was one of the first times I thought, wow, he's not RoboCop.
Yeah, I think, like I said earlier, I think we didn't know quite what to make him, because he didn't make of him on the course, because he didn't give us a lot.
Yeah.
Kept so much of it hidden. And I had heard from multiple people through the years, like, boy, Duvall's a really good guy. If you could get to know him and go out and talk to him, he's fascinating and has a lot of interest and really well read and really has a good sort of wide world view there. And and the time I got to spend with him, I mean, that was reinforced. And I think he that there is a lot of emotion there. I mean, to hear him talk about his new family and the life he has now, I mean, it's inspiring.
Yeah. So jump back a tiny bit then. The death of his brother when he's 12 years old, that's a fairly important moment in Duvall's life, clearly.
Yeah, hugely important. Years ago at the top of his game, Sports Illustrated did a really in-depth profile on him and focused on that whole story and told it and from multiple perspectives, I guess. And, he and his brother were tight. And then his brother developed a rare disease, and David was one of the donors trying to help save his life, and it ultimately didn't work. And I think, he lost his brother and one of his, maybe his best friend. And he said it affected him tremendously. I didn't go as deep into it in the story, in this story, because it had been done by a couple other times, and I was sort of trying to spin it now. But I mean, it was, it, in a lot of ways changed the course of his life or impacted the course of his life and him. And it's you can tell it's still tender. I mean, he I think he has a real softness to him that we may not always see. And I think that story touches at the very soul of it.
Mm. Well, and understandably so, I suppose. I mean, it ruptured the family. His parents' marriage didn't survive the death, as, you know, terribly so often happens after an event like that. So, I mean, his whole life really took a different path from that age. And he wouldn't be the first player in history to find respite and comfort in the solitary existence of a golf course.
Exactly. He sort of immersed himself there, and he could be with his dad some there, and his dad helped him build him into the player he became. And
right.
You know, David,
right.
You're right. I mean, we've heard many stories of guys who, whether they were socially awkward or just didn't feel like they belonged to this group or that, they could go to the golf course, and that became their sanctuary. And I think in a lot of ways that happened with David, and we saw where it led.
So the existential moment then, like you write in your piece after that win, days later, Duval began to wonder what it all meant. All the work, all the hours, all the highs and lows, somehow, some way, he expected the view from the summit to be different. It's a bit of what I call an existential moment, Duval says. You figure winning a major will make you feel on top of the world for a long, long time, and then you realise it doesn't. So hugely interesting. I mean, like, what an amazingly fascinating thing for any athlete to reveal. So people can butcher cause and effect here, and they can take that open win and what he says about the existential moment and his subsequent decline, and they can say, well, 2 + 2 = 5 here, and that is the reason. He almost, something died in him when it came to golf and sport and the importance of golf. You feel that's overstated, Ron?
Well, in talking to David, he does not lay it all there. He points out that, and I think I get the number, I think he had 12 serious or, you know, impactful injuries. And health problems, physical problems, begin to mount at about the same time. And he played through this and played through that. And, you know, it was hard for him to play. It got more difficult just to go out and swing the club and, you know, to practice as often as you need to and make the commitments you'd need. And I think that's where it began to erode a little bit, because he was, whether it was back or knees, elbows, things, necks, things like that. And so when that dulled an edge, and then suddenly confidence is so much a part, as we know, and for all of us in golf, but particularly at that level, they sort of have an unbending, undentable confidence, and suddenly his was dented, and his fall was pretty stark. I mean, when it went fast and never really came back, though he will contend today if he had more playing opportunities, he still thinks he could be competitive.
Right. And I think that's why the fascination lingers amongst us all, is because the ascent went so high and he was so brilliant, and then the fall was so dramatic and so sudden after that win. You make the point in your piece, in a 115 tournament stretch from 03 through to 09, Duval missed the cut 76 times, withdrew 5 times. You say he was a ghost. So that's between 03 and 09, 115 tournaments, 76 missed cuts and withdrawing 5 times. And that's 03 to 09. In 2002 as well, his partner of 8 years, Julie MacArthur, they break up. So who knows what kind of emotional turmoil that caused him as well. I presume that's not something he overly wants to discuss.
Yeah, we didn't talk too much about it. It's sort of there. The statistics or the results speak for themselves. Mm. I remember watching him a couple of times because he knew who he was and knew what he had done. And, you know, there's sort of a odd fascination when something goes so wrong as that did. I remember watching him at the Wells Fargo Championship at Quail Hollow, and he would play some good holes. He played some good holes. And then suddenly I remember him stepping up to the first tee at Quail Hollow. It was his 10th hole. And sailing it impossibly high over some trees, practically into what you could call as an adjoining fairway, but nobody would really consider it an adjoining fairway because you would never think about hitting the ball over there. But he just hit this massive high slice block, whatever, over there, and you think, well, there it is. And, you know, he would occasionally make the big number. And, you know, he could play 14, 15, 16 holes well, and then suddenly there'd be the big one that would creep up in it. And, he went from a curiosity to where he just became sort of a shadow.
Yeah. He said in 2012 at the Open, you quote him, "I never got to hate golf. If I hated it, I would have stopped doing it." So he never got to that point for him.
No, and I remember, I guess it was the Open over there at St. Andrews, the last one, a couple years ago. He played well, had a good, I'll get my rounds wrong, second or third round, and actually stopped in the media center and talked, and as you'd expect, a lot of us crowded around to hear what he had to say. And you could just see the joy and feel the joy and satisfaction coming from him. And I remember his caddy Bambi just almost tearing up talking about how much it meant to see David play that way again.
Right.
And it didn't last, but he has flashes, and like I said, he is past the point of wanting to ask for sponsor exemptions, and feels like that sort of window has closed on him. So he doesn't really play much. He shows up a couple places, and I talked to him at the Open Championship, and he just had a couple holes there, made a triple somewhere that really derailed one round. And, he comes off thinking about how, like most golfers can, if I take this, and this off, I make the cut and I'm playing the weekend. So it's not terribly far away. But again, when you play three or four times, it's a whole different game you're dealing with.
He's remarried, and he married his wife 7 months after meeting her.
Yeah, great story about being the old tournament out in Colorado, the International, and he was staying at the clubhouse there and wasn't going to go out that night. And finally his coach, mental coach or whatever you want to call it, convinced him, let's go. And they went up to this place, you go in Denver, and said they almost turned around. And he decided to go in and meets this woman, and his wingman the talker sort of engaged the people there and made the introduction, and all of a sudden whatever clicks, and wasn't long after he was flying back out there to see her, and one thing led to another. And I mean, you just, as I said earlier, you hear him talk about his family, and he it's like he woke up with a pot of gold, and just, it's just the greatest thing that ever happened to him.
That's great. "We knew after the first date we were going to be together," is the quote he had for you. And then, so this, I suppose, a reemergence of sorts in the commentary booth, where I first noticed Duval was when he was having that huge argument with Brandel Chamblee at the Ryder Cup about the lack of leadership, and Duval was defending the US Ryder Cup team and just how much they want to win. And you tell a lovely story as well. I mean, after that telecast, which went viral and certainly reached these shores as well, he went back to the US Ryder Cup team hotel.
Yeah, he was staying there and sort of walked in the team room, and they had seen it, and they gave him a big round of applause and cheered him. And David said it was very awkward. He would rather that have not had happened. But that's sort of, I don't know if there's a point where this story sort of began to kick around in my head. That sort of brought it home because, I mean, he was not a contrarian, but he did what people in that position are paid to do. I mean, he's paid to have an opinion, paid to have some insight into what's going on. And now, as both he and Brandel say, and David said, I took it too far. I made it personal at the very end, and he regrets doing that. But I think it showed the world what he could be as a commentator.
Yeah.
And I think, he even in television, he's got this sort of hip, modern, contemporary vibe to him, the way he dresses with the goatee, the glasses. I mean, he's cool looking on TV. I mean, like my sister, she watches a good bit of golf, her son, college golfer and all this stuff. She loves it when Duval is on. She just thinks he's the coolest thing. And then you throw that in with the fire he showed there.
Yeah.
And, I think he and Brandel talked about it and hashed it out. And, Brandel was surprised, sort of blindsided by how resolute David was in his opinion there, but it worked. Maybe it, like I said, maybe it got just a hair too personal, as David admitted later. But I think from then on, people realized, hey, this is that's pretty good TV. I think they do a really, really good job with those live from shows on the Golf Channel from the major championships, and Duval's a huge part of that.
And you got to shadow them and watch them at work a little bit. So you've got Chamblee and Frank Nobilo, who I think everybody likes. He just seems like a thoroughly decent, intelligent fella. And you've got Duval there as well. The three of them seem to be having a good time off air as much as on air.
Yeah, I mean, kidding each other and all that. It's funny because you see this lovely grand television production, and you know, after play that one day I'm wandering over there and I get there before Duvall, and they all sort of come in at their own time, and Duvall comes sauntering in later, you know, shirt sort of untucked and sneakers on, and walks up the stairs and sort of just low-key David Duvall, and goes over there and changes, puts on a fresh shirt, one he hadn't sweated through because it was so hot that day, and suddenly, you know, goes over and gets his makeup on, and they're just kidding each other. And yeah, I mean, there seemed to be a nice easiness to it, comfort level there.
Yeah. People should certainly check out the piece, Ron. Global Golf Post is where they can read it. You wrote at one point, Duvall now looks like a guy you might find buried in a chair at a college coffee shop reading something with more depth than the daily sports page. And you said he's got bigger, wider interests. What kind of stuff is he interested in, do we know?
Well, I think, you know, he talks about how much fun he has with his kids. You know, he and his stepson won the father-son tournament last year, I guess it was in December down in Orlando. And, I mean, that's just one of the proudest moments, happiest moments of his life. I think he's got to decide, and I think he's right at that point now, he's got to decide if he wants to really seriously continue to entertain the idea of playing professional golf or fully commit to the television side of it.
Yeah.
I think that's the biggest thing. I think, excuse me, Johnny Miller's got just signed on for another year. But at some point, Johnny Miller's chair is coming open. Mm. I mean, could David Duvall be the guy? I think if he shows the television administration that he wants that, I think it's something he would have a really good shot at getting. But I think you've got to show that that's what you want. And I think, as he said earlier, you know, Molly Solomon from the Golf Channel went up and tried to convince him to give TV a try. And he sort of needed convincing, like, do you really think I could do this? And, well, nice. I think we know now he can do it. I think he has to decide if that's what he wants to sort of make his next career. I think it's certainly trending that way, and I think he would be wise if that's what he did. But, you know, I mean, he's got kids and stepkids and the life in Denver. He lives out there, plays Cherry Hills, throw a bag on his shoulder and go walk 9 holes in the afternoon with one of his kids. I mean, he's got it pretty good. So it'll be interesting to see where he goes from here.
Yeah, very interesting. Because, I mean, I know people with real jobs will quite rightly scoff, but like Johnny Miller's chair, that's a tough job. That's a lot of travel. That's a huge commitment week in, week out. I mean, I guess one of the reasons he could do it, we all watch and we instantly respect his opinion, and he's very likable way about him in that he's not trying to be likable, he's just being who he is. But the other thing which came across in your piece, not least through Tiger Woods, is just how much respect the other players have for his opinion still. You know, you talk about Tiger Woods privately emailing to say how much he respected Duvall as a player and how much he still respects his opinion. And it just goes to show, you know, longevity is very important and everything, but even in that short spell where Duvall burned brightly, he burned so brightly that even Woods, everybody at the pinnacle of the game, massively respect what this guy has to say.
You can't manufacture that. That has to come sort of organically, and it did. And what Tiger said, it was very nice to respond via email to me, because I knew he and Duvall had sort of a pretty good relationship. And, you know, Duvall was very...
Sorry to interrupt. I mean, Tiger Woods is not in the habit of email exchanges with journalists,
to put it mildly.
So did you have a kind of relationship with Tiger, or was it the fact that he knew you were doing a piece on Duvall and it was his respect for Duvall which coerced him into cooperating?
Well, I think it's both. I've been fortunate. I met Tiger, you know, 20 years ago, early on in his career, and been around him a whole lot, and, you know, I think there's a few of us that, you know, have a pretty good relationship. I know he's got a lot of journalists don't really, aren't really fond of Tiger and dealing with him, because there's a lot of walls and layers and barriers there, but he's been great to me. And there's a handful of us who feel like we've been able to, we're not friends, but, you know, when we see each other, stop and chit chat and catch up and all that. And so I just said, I'll take a chance. Here's what I'm doing. Here's some questions. Get them to him. And only took a day later, and they were back. And I was like, well, that's I thought that said a lot about what Tiger thinks of Duvall.
Yeah. Really interesting. Well, I'll tell you what, if you don't mind, another stage, Ron, when you're not busy, we might chat to you about the Tiger Woods you've seen over the last 20 years. So one last point then. I guess this is one you can't answer for sure. And I guess it's a mixture of everything. But the Duval fall then, I guess your theory, because he wins the Open, as we said, and he has that existential moment where you figure, he says, it's going to make you feel top of the world for a long, long time, and you realise it doesn't. Now, I appreciate there were injuries after that, a lot of injuries, and I appreciate there was the breakup of his relationship, but the existential moment reason is so compelling. The majority of athletes, they either win something as big as the Open, and it's so amazing and so glorious that it satisfies them for a very long time, and they don't kick on and have the desire to win other tournaments. But it is everything they hoped it would be. It satisfies them hugely. Or it's also so bloody good. It's like some kind of drug. It's like heroin. It's like, I need more of this. I need to keep on getting this feeling. Duval is interesting in that he's neither of those two categories. If you had to guess, I mean, I can't help but feel if he had won the Open and it had been like a drug to him, like heroin, he would have kicked on and won more. Such was his talent.
Yeah, I mean, as you're talking about that, I'm sitting here thinking of Jordan Spieth having just won the Open Championship and in the way he did it. And now we got the PGA coming up next. Yeah. And he just, I mean, he it's almost like he wants to devour.
Yeah, for him it's a drug, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, that's what drives him. I think that's what has driven Rory for a while. And yeah, for Duval, I just think it's it was different. It sort of fit who he was, because he didn't fit the mold of anybody else. I mean, he sort of had his own path. You know, had he stayed healthy, you know, maybe he goes and gets another one. But you know, I go back to Curtis Strange talking years ago, spent some time with him about, you know, he won back-to-back U.S. Opens and nearly won a third. Had a chance, I guess, in 90 at Medina to make it three in a row, which is basically unheard of. And when he didn't win, he said he can remember going back that night and feeling a little bit of something drain out of him, and it never came back. You know, he never won another golf tournament after he won that second Open. Mm. And something, he said, left. You know, I still wanted to do well, but whatever it was. And I wonder if, you know, maybe just a little – you know, Duval opened the faucet a little bit and something drained out and he never got it back in there. But I mean, he's a hugely influential player and now an influential voice in the game. And, you know, it's led him here. I mean, there's a lot of wondering what it could have been, but it sure was good while it lasted.
Yeah. Well, listen, Ron, people should read the piece. Global Golf Post is where they can check out your work. We might have that chat with you about Tiger at another stage. You are, by the way, at Akron. I know you're rushing off to watch the play. Rory and his caddy, we've been talking about. Going to be interesting to see how the next few days go.
It will be interesting to see. Yeah, I think I was reminded of an old NBA basketball coach talking one day. He said, you know, we have a finite life in what we do as coaches, he said, because after a while, I get tired of talking to them and saying the same things, and they get tired of hearing the same things. And so it's just time to shake things up. And I think that's what Rory said. You know, I thought it was a really nice thing he said here. Say, I didn't want a professional relationship to ruin a personal relationship. And it was just time. And didn't rule out the fact, possibility of JP coming back at some point. But I think something's been missing with Rory. And, you know, this is a good time to try it. So we'll see where it goes.
Yeah. Ron Green, pleasure to have you on. Thanks so much.
Appreciate it very much. Enjoyed it.
There you go. Ron Green Jr., Global Golf Post is where you can read his work, and we'll chat to him about his relationship, or I don't want to overstate relationship, but certainly he's on first term and reasonably friendly basis with Tiger Woods, so we'll see what he's made of the changes in Woods' personality as much as anything over the last 20-odd years. Final thoughts, WGC is on. This is always good, a good tournament. It's interesting in that there's a North course and a South course there. I think they play the North course. But basically, everybody who's been there says the other course is much nicer. It's there's far more variety to it. There's more water. There's a lot more going on.
Whereas, is the one the Tiger won 8 times or whatever it is?
Yeah, this one. This is the one they always play.
All right.
But you never get to see the other one from a TV point of view. They never play it. So the criticism of Firestone is that, like, from a TV point of view, it's just up, down, up, down, up, down, 400 and something yard par fours, trees. It's just deathly similar. However, all the players seem to love it. They think it's an unbelievably fair challenge, one of the fairest challenges they get. Always finds a good winner. I guess if Tiger Woods wins there 8 times, that's a good enough sign. So that's what's going on. The Firestone. This is where Shane Lowry won, isn't it?
Yeah, 2 years ago.
2 years ago.
Yep.
It's my favorite time of the golfing year.
It's good, yeah.
It's not my favorite tournament, obviously, but you've got
No Ryder Cup, Dave.
It's no Ryder Cup. It's no Masters, but you've got two majors and a WGC event in a 4-week span, and never in the golfing calendar is there as much to enjoy.
Well, with Rory and Spieth having good day ones, the hope is they're in the mix come Sunday. So we'll keep a very close eye on that.
A word for Bernhard Langer.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Go on. Oh yeah, Bernhard.
He won the senior open at the weekend. That's his 10th senior major. It's his third this year alone, and he is the most successful major player in seniors golf history.
You know what? We played the clip of him giving out about the accusations he was cheating last week. He did very well to actually put that to one side and say, I don't care if people are going to call me a cheat. I'm going to go out there and win anyway. Because did you see Charlie Hoffman engineered the most dodgy drop in a bunker this week at the Canadian Open? It was comical. He was in a fried egg, absolutely screwed lie. And he found some really strange ruling. There was something to do with where his feet were. I mean, it was really, really dodgy stuff.
But was it within the rules?
Yes.
Well, then what's your problem?
I mean, to the extent that his playing partner, I can't remember his name, but Hoffman got the ruling and got to take a drop in the bunker, he was walking off to have a look at the hole then, Hoffman, after he'd taken the drop. And even his friend, they're good friends, the two of them, the commentary team were saying, but even his friend was saying to the referee, you should see Hoffman's face as he walks by me. Even he's laughing. That's how ridiculous this is. You know, it was sort of good-natured ribbing, but there was a part of it that was, there was an edge to it a little bit. But there, you know, he was like, you should, because Hoffman had his back to the camera and he was like, even this guy's laughing right now. And Hoffman duffs the bunker shot then. And I think it's because he felt guilty. A little bit guilty.
Interesting.
So it's like Robbie Fowler missing the penalty.
And I think I was fully expecting that Langer would miss some putts, but he's just too goddamn mentally strong.
Well, he won by four
strong.
Shots, so he could have missed a couple and it wouldn't have been a big issue. Yeah. Did you see the culmination of the semi-finals of the Women's Junior Amateur Championship in the States last week?
No.
Where there was two American golfers, and it was in the first hole of sudden death. It was match play. And one of the girls misses a putt and runs it 1 foot, 2 foot past, and immediately just rakes her ball back to take a practice putt without so much as glancing at her opponent.
So she didn't wait for the concession.
She didn't wait for the concession. And the camera was over the shoulder, was peering over the shoulder of her opponent. And the second the golfer who'd hit the putt raked her ball back in her own direction, her opponent just turned to the camera with this incredible look of amusement on her face going, oh shit, what just happened here? And
what happened?
Well, the referee, match referee, just had to come in and she had to administer the penalty straight away. One hole penalty, it's sudden death, you've lost the semi-final.
And unbelievable.
The reason why I was watching it was very interesting that the social media reaction was very much 50-50. A lot of it was, well, look, she should know the rules and you can never concede even a one-inch putt until you're absolutely sure your opponent has conceded it. A lot of people were saying, well, her opponent should have lied to the referee and said, no, it was conceded, it was fine.
Yeah.
Because she was already walking off to the next hole.
Yeah, I think she should have as well, actually.
I don't know. The rules are the rules.
Sure.
What are your thoughts, Fionn?
Yeah.
Because she hadn't conceded the putt. She was, going to concede it. I'm sure she was.
Yeah.
I don't think she was expecting her opponent to putt.
How
it.
Far past?
Oh, 2 feet max.
Unmissable.
Yeah. Like, unmissable this putt, yeah.
Yeah, I think she should have. It would have been a wonderful Nicholas-esque moment of goodwill.
Yeah, outside in Donegal, as they say, oh, that's inside the whiskey bottle.
Yeah,
it has to be, you know, so 18 inches.
Bloody hell. We're pretty much done. We're pretty much out of time. So, Fionn, thank you so much for...
No problem, guys. Pleasure.
...the effort. And we will, in some shape or form, hopefully with Seamus Parris, speak to you all next week. Good luck.
All my exes were